Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at texasmutual.com.
From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, lynching and leisure. From the late 19th to mid-20th century, the public torture and execution of African Americans became a form of entertainment in Texas. What is the legacy of the Texas style of lynching today?
What they wanted to do was send a message to the entirety of the Black community to say, you need to stay in your place.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Be aware that in this discussion about the history of lynching in Texas, we're using frank language that is disturbing because we're talking about a disturbing series of events that are horrible. Lynching in Texas used to be a mostly secret and clandestine method of extra-legal execution for horse thieves and supporters of the Union, like in the 1862 Great Hanging at Gainesville. After the Civil War, lynching transformed from being perverted frontier justice into a warped form of public entertainment designed to terrorize the Black population with nightmarish, hyperviolent torture sessions that were on full display. In her new book, Lynching and Leisure, Terry Ann Scott, Ph.D., examines how lynching came to function not only as a tool for debasing the status of Black people, but also as entertainment and recreation for the white communities in Texas. The chair of the Department of History at Hood College in Maryland produced a comprehensive study of Texas lynchings, which sheds new light on the practice that was a strategy of racial domination, and argues that in a new form, it continues today.
What I set out to do was to examine why it is that the act of lynching in Texas, which once was something that predominantly white people were lynched, they were lynched by masked individuals in the cover of night, and this was in the mid-19th century, and then during the Civil War and a little bit after, that transitions to a different kind of violence that becomes a racialized violence where the vast majority of victims were African-American. The masks were removed. They were done in the middle of the day. There was no fear of punishment. And added to that was spectacle and recreation. And so people's bodies being turned into vendable items and souvenirs, postcards from the events, people taking excursion trains and talking about the joy and pleasure that they experienced from the event. That's what I set out to do, is to understand that transition, because the transition is, I document it well in the book and demonstrate that these are the different things that factor into this different type of racialized violence that we see. And then I try to explore, you know, why is that? There's no singular reason. Why is it that Black people became the center of entertainment in this form of violence?
You look at Texas, and when people frequently talk about lynchings, they automatically assume other parts of the South, like maybe Mississippi or Louisiana. They don't really jump automatically to Texas, but Texas has that history, and it was very dominant in the lynching culture. There was even, they call it the Texas way of doing a lynching. Can you explain what the Texas way of doing a lynching was?
I definitely can. Yes, I talk about Texas because my research has demonstrated that Texas actually falls in number three in the country in the highest states, the number of lynchings. Third place. Some studies previously had it in fourth and fifth. I discovered a number of additional lynchings. So even before my study comes out, we see that Texas was one of the main states that lynched individuals, particularly African Americans. And yes, you note that that other states said the Texas way, particularly in terms of burning. I have a whole chapter in the book, Lynching and Leisure, about burning Black people. There were no white lynching victims who were burned to death in the state of Texas. This was a type of punishment that was reserved for Black people. And other states, and I see this through people's pundits' conversations at the time, newspaper articles, when Georgia or a different state would burn a person, they would reference Texas and say the person had been done Texas style, or they use the Texas method. And so it was well known, even though sometimes it doesn't factor into our idea of what Texas is now, it was well known at the time that Texas really led the charge and created a script in terms of lynching people.
There was a carnival-like atmosphere focused on this horrific act of violence that illustrated man's inhumanity to man, and the burning, the cutting, the hanging, one thing after another. Medieval is just not even enough to describe the extent of the bloodlust of the crowd for this human being who is being just tortured to death in this manner. How does that become entertainment?
I mean, it's a great question, right? There are some factors of it that we can never fully kind of understand why somebody would engage in this. And to push it off and marginalize it, which some people like to do and say, well, that's just kind of what was of the time. That's not true either, because there were huge anti-lynching campaigns mounted against this kind of action. So it wasn't just the standard, this is how we do it. It became, though, part of this kind of state culture in many spaces in the state of Texas and in other places in the South. For instance, when there was a lynching of Jesse Washington in Waco, Texas, in 1915, a woman for the NAACP, her name was Elizabeth Freeman, she was an investigator and went and talked to people. And she found some people who were opposed to the lynching. And she said to them, why didn't you speak up about this? And these were white residents. And they said, because if I speak out against this, I might find myself killed as well, because it was such a part of the culture of the community. And so how do we find ourselves at that? Well, after the Civil War, when slavery ends, then freedom comes in. And so there is a new look for a rearranged racial hierarchy to ensure black at the bottom and white on top, as had occurred under enslavement. So as you have the rise of Jim Crow laws, you also have a need to reestablish white supremacy. And lynching offered one of those forms of racialized social control to reestablish white supremacy. And you could lynch somebody for a quote unquote crime. The issue here is that after the Civil War, the concept of crime changes. And so when we think about a crime today as murder or larceny, at the time, you had to factor in race as part of this crime. What do I mean? Black people's freedom expressions became criminalized. And so people were lynched, for instance, for voting or for organizing people to move out of the state and to Africa. And so any freedom expression of African Americans became criminalized because it took them out of, quote unquote, their place and where they were supposed to be. So not only then do you have lynching as becoming part of the social order, you also have this dehumanization of black people that comes along with making them the center of one's recreational events. And so you have black popular culture, misrepresentations of black popular culture becoming very popular at the time. Postcards of black babies being eaten by alligators, the mammy salt and pepper shakers. Black people became objectified at the same time that white supremacy was firmly establishing them at the bottom of the racial hierarchy without enslavement. And so you have all of these things coming together, and I chart all of them in the book, including migratory patterns that bring black people into cities and towns and create further anxiety and racial discord because of job competition, labor competition. All of these things coming together create this kind of storm where black people could be lynched. There is no punishment against the people who are lynching them, and you can make it as dehumanizing and despicable and disgusting as one wishes. And you feel that you are on top of the world, that you are above a person when you can do this and center them as part of your leisure activity. And so in the book, I chart all of this throughout the book.
During this era, there was talk of, quote unquote, the new Negro. Mm-hmm. And that term had different meanings depending on which group you're in. Can you talk about what that meant and who used that term differently?
Absolutely. And it speaks a little bit to what I was talking about, this new concept. And it all has to do with after enslavement. So when the Civil War ends in 1865, the 13th Amendment ends slavery, and you begin to have an increase, for instance, in African-American political power with the 15th Amendment and the 1867 First Reconstruction Act, which was short-lived. And you have African Americans asserting political power before Reconstruction ends, and then Jim Crow takes over. What you have are African Americans who are asserting freedom, who are voting, who are establishing community. And at the time, they then referred to themselves as the new Negro. I am a new Negro. I am not the enslaved Negro. I am the person who is going to advance, who is educated, who is voting. Well, this same moment, the same concept of the new Negro, you have white Southerners disparaging that, using it as a pejorative, saying that this new Negro is indolent, disrespectful. They don't know their place. And so therefore, we must put them back in their place.
One of the crimes that was used to justify lynching or attacking, beating up, brutalizing African Americans was gloating over the victory, the boxing match victory, the Great White Hope, 1910, July 4th boxing match with Jack Johnson. Just acting like you knew about it was enough, was an excuse to be targeted by groups. So any kind of infraction at all would you wouldn't know how that would trigger the white community to attack you.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the most famous lynchings, I think, that comes out of the era was in 1892 when Ida B. Wells writes about her friends who owned a grocery store called the People's Grocery in Memphis, Tennessee. And they were lynched for the crime of having a grocery store that was more successful than the white grocery store owner in the area. And so to your point, with it's as asinine and as horrific as lynching people, killing people who were happy about the victory of Jack Johnson beating the quote-unquote Great White Hope of Jim Jeffries in 1910.
When they, you know, they made a film, they used the new technology of the time. They shot the film of the boxing match. But when that film toured the South, they edited out the ending. They didn't include the final knockout.
That's correct. They didn't include the final knockout, and there were anti-miscegenation laws passed in different places across the country as a result of that boxing match. And interracial boxing matches were illegalized in some spaces, and the showing of the film was also made illegal in some spaces.
We had soldiers who fought, African-American soldiers who fought in World War I, World War II, heroic individuals fought for making the world safe for democracy, fighting against Nazi Germany and fascism. And then they returned back to their homes in the South wearing their uniforms. That was enough to be targeted.
Indeed it was. And the irony of that, and so people going overseas to fight for democracy abroad and coming home not only to a Jim Crow space, but to a space where you are targeted for wearing this uniform, the irony of it was not lost on African Americans. And what it ends up doing, both during World War I and World War II, is really begins to incite a lot of civil rights activity. And so when we talk about the beginning, for instance, of a modern civil rights era, many people make that start at, for the modern era, at World War II, when Black veterans are coming back and they can't even vote in this country, or they are beaten to death. Or in the case of one very famous Black veteran, his eyes were gouged out because he wouldn't give up his seat on a bus when he had his uniform on.
So in your book, you talk about the spectacle of the lynching and how communities would come together for this. There, all the cultural institutions, even the local newspaper, would sanction these lynchings, even the Dallas Morning News. And I do have to wonder how these newspapers, that are, many of them are still in existence today, do they have something to atone for?
You know, I mean, I would say some of them do. I know that there were moments where the Dallas Morning News, for instance, when the Klan had reemerged, where they very much were anti-Klan, to the point where they spoke so freely against the Klan that they lost readership because of it. There were some newspapers, for instance, in some spaces in San Antonio and other places, that condemned what was going on. But by and large, the newspapers condoned it. They convicted the lynching victim in the public mind, and I write about this in the book, before a trial even occurred. A trial most of the time didn't occur. It would say, Black rapist fiend captured and will be lynched. I mean, they indicted them in the titles, in the very headlines that they put out to the public. And so they helped create a narrative of blackness and criminality that led to the lynching occurring.
The lynching itself was a form of communication to African-American communities to terrorize them, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It sent a message not only to the individual, but what they wanted to do was send a message to the entirety of the black community to say, you need to stay in your place. I mean, I use actually a postcard in the book that says, and it's a postcard of five African-American men hanging from a tree, and it was sold. And it says that the poem reads something along the lines of, this is a land of white man rule, and the Negro will learn how to stay in his place. And the other form of trying to keep using lynching to trying to scare African-Americans and keep them in their quote unquote place was that once the car was invented and became a part of the lynching, both by driving people to lynchings and by illuminating the scenes of lynchings when it was nighttime, it was regular practice to take the body, whether the body had been hanged or burned or shot, tie it to the back of an automobile and drive the body through the African-American portion of town as a warning.
Yeah, so that's what happened to James Byrd in Jasper, Texas, where he was tied behind a pickup truck and died being dragged to death.
He did, and I believe they left portions of his body in front of a black church. Their conviction represents one of the only times in the history of Texas that people were convicted for lynching a black person.
The fact that it was a community event to have the lynching, and young and old would come out for this. They would have this almost like ritual type of event where they would whip the crowd into a frenzy and the crowd would whip the people doing the lynching into a frenzy. But the fact that everyone was involved in it in some way kind of created this corruption that if everyone had a piece of it, then no one could be held accountable.
That's correct. No one would be held accountable. Law enforcement was often a part of it. So at times, victims would be taken from law enforcement. Other times, law enforcement would be part of the lynching party. People had time to do to Black people whatever they wanted to do. It takes time, for instance, to create a funeral pyre and put a Black person on top of it and burn them and wait for the ashes to cool so that you can find souvenirs from the ashes. So we're talking about hours. And they were not stopped, and they did not fear punishment. They took pictures with no mask. They took postcards. They wrote to their friends and sent it to people and said, this is me. I'm very much in the bunch. Hope to hear from you soon, read one of the postcards from Dallas, for instance. Postcards came out of Temple, Texas, Waco, Texas, various spaces. So, indeed, absolutely.
You said they would scramble for souvenirs from the remains of the individuals, cutting off body parts, including the genitalia.
Genitalia, they would take pieces of the chains or the ropes that were used to kill people. They would take pieces of clothing, pieces of the scaffolding that often was used when they would place people higher up so the crowds could see them. Photographers knew that they would make money, and so they would often position themselves when they heard that a lynching was going to occur close enough so that they could get good shots and then sell those photographs on the street. And so this became this very much like a carnival kind of atmosphere where people could go and leave school or work, and they would attend these lynchings in a self-directed manner. You need three things that are required to call something leisure. And this is something that comes out of all of the scholarships. When you boil it down, it has to be self-directed. You garner pleasure from it, and it's done away from time and work. And this is what we see repeatedly with these things. There are also phonographic renderings taken of the torture, and then they were replayed at fairs across the country.
So audio recordings of this on these, I guess, Edison-like cylinder devices?
Mm-hmm.
Those still exist?
You know, I have heard that they do. I have not heard them. I've just heard from other scholars that they think that at least one from the lynching of Henry Smith from 1893 in Paris, Texas, still exists.
I mean, is it like the screaming and the hollering and the...
Yes. So there's an African-American veterinarian from Seattle, Washington, who writes very expansively about it. He writes several years, just a few years, actually, under 10 years after Henry Smith was lynched. And he was walking down the street in Seattle, Washington. And he said he saw people making a fuss over some sound recording on a phonograph. So he was curious. And then he describes what he heard, and he hears the torture of this man. And he said that he thought that in his northwestern new space, that things would be different and he wouldn't see people garnering entertainment from the torture of a person.
This shows you how technology, even back then, was allowing this to be portable and preserving the terror and the terrorizing so that you never know where it can go, something that we experience today.
Absolutely. And I write a lot about the technology. I also talk a lot in Lynching and Leisure about economic changes in the state of Texas that led both to lynching as well to the leisure aspect of it. And in the back of the book, I have an appendix that lists all of the victims of lynching in the state, as many as I could find, where they were lynched, how, by how many people, et cetera. And I try to include narratives because it becomes very clear when you do this research, and I'm obviously not the first scholar to say this, that many of the people who were accused of these crimes did not commit these crimes. And should I say most, they were false accusations. They were ways to eliminate people from society, to scare people. And so I try to bring the lives, the biographies of the lynching victims to life as much as I could in the book.
So the federal government would not get involved. We would have people who would write letters to the president, whether it be Woodrow Wilson or FDR, saying, please do something about these lynchings. And then what would happen?
They'd refer them back. At one point, Woodrow Wilson, who really, his biographers can tell you, was really known as a racist. I think that's easy to clarify or to state that at this point, did make a speech at one point and urged people to stop lynching. But the federal government, the Department of Justice, because most of these letters are there, would refer people back to their local entities, to their state and local governments. And so, of course, that did nothing for them because it was the state and local governments who were allowing these acts to go unchecked. And so they were just stuck in this horrific circle where they could not get any federal intervention. Over the course of over 100 years in this country, more than 200 lynching bills have been presented to Congress. The first one passed 2 months ago.
And referring these back to their local law enforcement basically put a target on the back of the people who were complaining. The local sheriff, who is an elected official, and others, they were in on it.
Undoubtedly, yeah. One man actually, at the scene of one of the lynchings of Henry Smith, it was an African-American reverend who loudly proclaimed, stop, there are children here, we shouldn't do this. They hit him with a pistol, knocked him out, and then kicked him out of town. So you were not supposed to speak out against this.
And the federal government response was, this is a local issue, this is states' rights.
Correct, which is what the federal government responded so many times when we talk about the history of racial terror and racial discrimination in this country. The first Civil Rights Act was passed in 1875, and it said you can't discriminate in places of public accommodation. The Supreme Court knocked that down in 1883 and said that's a states' rights issue. We did not have another similar piece of legislation until the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Sometimes it's easy to claim this only happened there. This only occurred in the South, but it required the federal government's either Supreme Court rulings or lack of willingness to be involved for these things to continue.
In your book, you point out that lynchings was a process that evolved. It was one thing, it became another, and it became another, depending on the times. Mm-hmm. The purpose wasn't so much to although it happened, they tortured individuals to death, but it was really to send a message to the African-American community as to be careful, this could happen to you. We could wipe out your entire community if we so choose, and nothing could stop us. It was to terrorize. Some people say that's what is still happening today. You write about George Floyd. You write about other individuals who, African-Americans, who have been publicly murdered, killed by law enforcement. Also, we just had the mass shooting in Buffalo, a white supremacist being able to go in there and kill black people.
Mm-hmm. I mean, absolutely. That's the sad part of it, is thinking about the historical continuum. In my epilogue, I write about the lynching of Ahmaud Arbery and George Floyd and Elijah McClain, and I demonstrate how these two are modern day lynching. So when people ask me, when did lynching end? I say it hasn't ended. It may not occur as frequently, but it has not ended. And we still wonder and worry if the people will be convicted. This is why I know I sat on the edge of my seat last year for 2 weeks and watched every moment of the trial with Derek Chauvin, because I did not know if he would in fact be convicted. And I think a lot of people exhaled in knowing that that happened. We should not have had to have so much anxiety over wondering what would happen in that particular case. What happened then, what happened in Buffalo just a few days ago, their crime, the people who were murdered in Buffalo, was a crime of Black existence, just like I talk about in the book. And to say that it is horrific and sad to think that the crime of Black existence in a post-Civil War era will still get you killed in 2022 demonstrates that we have a lot of work to do, particularly in a moment when so many school districts across the country are trying to end the teaching of African-American history, end the teaching of race and racism. They call it CRT. If we ask them, what do you mean by CRT, they wouldn't know. I taught CRT twice in two upper level African-Americans and the law course in college, once at the University of Washington and once at Hood College. That is not something that is taught in schools. What they mean by that is, we don't want to talk about race and racism. We don't want to talk about the kind of history that is in Lynching and Leisure. We don't want to talk about racial violence. But when you don't do that, when we don't confront our history, we cannot learn from it and move forward from it. It is through education that we break down racial barriers. I have had students time and time again say to me, or say in evaluations, because they were ashamed to say it in person, I was taught one thing about African Americans. I believed XYZ, and now that I have taken your courses, now that we've talked about these things, I have a different understanding. That's why education is so important.
Lawmakers here in Texas who were in favor of passing these so-called CRT laws, banning the teaching of it in our public school system, complained that teaching this history would make kids feel bad, white kids feel bad, and that was their top concern.
And so, which then tells us that they have no concern about how not teaching the history makes Black kids feel, first of all. And so, because erasing the history of a people also makes them feel a particular way. The other thing that misses the mark on is, this is not their history versus our history versus your history. This is our collective history. We all are part of this history. We all are a product of this history. And we all have a right and a responsibility to know it and to learn from it and then to pass it forward. They don't want to talk about this, those lawmakers, because it makes them uncomfortable. When you teach this to children, they don't say, I'm the one who did that to my friend. They say, why would somebody do that to my friend? Why would someone do that to me? I'm not going to do that. So this is not about not making children feel uncomfortable. This is about erasing the history of white supremacy in this country so that people can imagine a world or pretend as though it never existed.
Terry Ann Scott, PhD, is a professor of American history and chair of the Department of History at Hood College in Maryland. She is the author of Lynching and Leisure, Race and the Transformation of Mob Violence in Texas. It's published by the University of Arkansas Press. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You can find past episodes of Texas Matters on our website at tpr.org. And you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at texasmutual.com.